but my reaction to those pictures.
An outline there, Bob. Yeah. Hey, whatever at this point comes to mind, where were you at the time? What, can you remember where you were, what you were singing that day?
Well, it's an old suit, and it had it's got pleats in it and so forth, so it had to be like 55 or 56. And the guy in the background is my first drummer, DJ Fontana.
So, those were the early days when you were doing the road tours and you were driving?
What were the appearances like then? What were the crowds like?
Oh, they were good. Yeah, they were really good. Just... that's the same guitar that I use now. Same one.
We had the same guitar all these years?
Mm-hmm. You're kidding. Yeah. I remember another one that said Elvis Presley on it. It's kind of inlaid.
Yeah, well, I have two, you know. Yeah. I was in a nightclub one night, and this big fight broke out in this club. I had two guitars. I always keep one on the side in case I break the strings. And I remember thinking, I hope that nothing happens to that guitar. It's brand new. I heard a crunch, and this guy had stepped in it. Had it hanging on his foot, man. So, had to get a new one there. But as far as where these were, I don't know.
You just had a small group with you, I know.
Yeah, I had a lead guitar player, a bass player, not an electric bass, an upright bass. A guy named Bill Black, and the drummer, that was it.
Were you doing one-nighters then?
Mm-hmm. Doing one-nighters, and I was working in Shreveport, Louisiana.
You know, that looks like a boom mic up there, so it might be one of the early TV shows.
And on this one here, I think somebody goosed me or something.
I see that hand back there.
Yeah, the guy had a guitar on it.
What was your sound like in those days? How would you describe it?
Well, it was good. It was good, you know, for then, I thought. The guys were good musicians. They were with me from the time I made the first record. They were called in by the guy that I started with, Sam Phillips, on Sun Records.
What was it like traveling in those days? I mean, that's a long time ago. How would you sleep?
We slept in the back of a car. And, you know, we'd do a show and we'd get off stage and get in a car, drive to the next town, and sometimes we'd get there just in time to the show. Wash up.
And the next day the same thing? Or?
Mm-hmm.
What were the security problems like then?
We had to learn that over a period of time. You know, I got caught in some pretty good crowds.
But the fans have always pretty much been the same, though, right? Large audiences and the same anticipation before and after. I mean, large numbers of people.
It was always exciting. As far as the numbers of people, we had to go according to the buildings, you know. And, when I first started out, they didn't have the buildings that they have now. You know, like I'd play like the Fox Theater in Detroit. And it didn't hold that many people, so I'd do six or seven shows. They'd show a movie, and I'd come on to a live show.
Really?
Yeah, they'd show a movie, and I'd do the show.
Was that the days when you had a lot of acts in the same show, too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was...
What kind of people were on the show?
Well, it was mostly people from the Grand Ole Opry at that time. I was an extra added attraction, you know, on the show.
At that particular time, other than Frank Sinatra, I can't remember anybody who had had wild, screaming crowds up until that point. Were you prepared at all for that possibility?
No, I wasn't. The first time it happened, the first time that I appeared on stage, it was a charity thing. It was a place called The Shell, and when I left the stage, they were yelling and screaming and so forth. I did two songs, and it scared me to death, man. I didn't know what I'd done. The manager backstage, I said, what'd I do? He said, well, whatever it is, go back and do it again. So I went back out and I did the same thing again. I really didn't know what the yelling was about, screaming. I didn't realize that I was moving, my body was moving or anything. It was a natural thing to me, you know.
It was not a conscious thing at all.
No, I wasn't even aware of it, just the rhythm. And the guy that played bass for me was, he could slap the bass, a double lick, you know. It was really a wild sound. It was like a jungle drums or something, you know, that nature. We enjoyed it, you know, we enjoyed it on stage. But it was very wild and we had to resist.
I don't know where that is.
It's outside.
Seattle.
Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot of outside concerts, but one of the bad things about outside is you lose your sound. The sound goes up.
Well, I guess in those days, the only big places to hold that number of people were outside, right?
Football stadiums and baseball stadiums, things like that.
But you never knew what to expect, huh?
No.
Like, we know what the security is like now and how you arrive in a big arena. How would you come in those days? Now you've been through an experience of having been scared by the reaction. What would you start to do? How would you arrive in the stadium?
As quietly as possible. But it was pretty well. I like the excitement and everything. It was.
Have the fans changed, Elvis? Over the
years? I don't think so. You know, I think I see people of all different ages and things out there. You know, if I do something good, you know, they let me know. If I don't, they let me know that. For a while, it was a theory that anything I did would sell and so forth. Well, I knew that was not true. It's according to the material. You got to have good material.
So
whether it's a song, a script, or whatever, it's got to be good.
Time just wrote an article on the Rolling Stones, and in the article they said only Elvis Presley, except for maybe Jagger, has that ability to play a crowd like a giant instrument panel, to tune them up and to tune them down. And we saw it on the tour.
In other words, you work the audience. What?
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Well, it's just it's a give and take proposition in that they give me back the inspiration and
kind of a circular thing.
Sure.
You give them something.
Sure. I work absolutely to them, whether it's 6 or 6,000, it doesn't really matter. It's just they bring it out of me, the inspiration. The ham.
If you go out there some night, sure. And say you're in 4 or 5 tunes and it just isn't coming back from the audience, what do you do?
I change the songs around. I'll go back and stay up all night working on it, you know, worrying about it. I'll find out what it is. It's not getting off the ground, you know, the first 4 or 5 numbers. Because that's very important, you know.
Do you ever play to one particular person in the audience? Do you ever single out, say, a girl that's on the side of the stage? Play to her?
That's difficult because of the lighting.
So
I can't hardly see them. You know, I can see them, but not in detail. You know.
And count the flash
bulbs. I will play off of an isolated incident, say, if somebody's really jumping them down or yelling or enjoying it or whatever. I'll play to that in a way, you know. Not all the time, but I'll go to it.
Let's talk about how the whole show has come to being. Because I know it's really your creation. You know, from every person up there is really somebody that's up there for a reason. Like, for instance, the stamps. How do they come to be picked?
Won a male gospel quartet on stage with me for background. So I simply find out who's doing the best at that particular time. And some of the best voices in the world are in that type of music, but you don't hear about them that much. So I had known J.D. Sumner from the time he started to work for this group called the Blackwood Brothers in Memphis. group that worked for me called the Imperials had a contract with somebody else. And when they left, I had to replace them, and so we called J.D. Sumner, and he told us about the Stamps, you know. It was a new group that just put together. The name of the Stamps has been around for years, but the groups have changed, and this was a new group that had just been put together. So they sent me some records of these guys, and I picked them on that basis. And the same with the girl singers. They had backed Aretha Franklin and a lot of other people.
Why was it important for us to have a male gospel group as part of the act? How did that fit in?
In other words, was there a certain feeling you were going after for your whole show?
Yeah.
I think one time.
I wanted musicians that could play any type of music. Lead guitar players and bass, piano, who could play classical or anything, which those guys can. And all the musicians were all handpicked. I auditioned musicians for days and days, drummers, guitar players. Somebody said, I said, who's the best guitar player around? And they said, well, Glenn Campbell and James Burton. And I said, well, Campbell's out. He's on his own, so. James Burton. But there's a lot of good, men around. It's just a matter of finding them. But they all just fit in, and fortunately, they knew most of my songs. You know.
But, I mean, you wanted voices behind you and...
I wanted voices behind me to help add to the fullness of the sound and to get the dynamics of the show.
And the same on the tour, why did you want to have a full orchestra?
Because of the places being so big and everything, I wanted to fill the room up with sound as much as I could, with music. And a lot of records have been orchestrated.
You mean like on arrangements like Bridge Over Troubled Water and American Trilogy?
Yeah, you've got to have that bigness there. You've got to have the dynamics of sound. I enjoy it. People wonder how I do it night after night or something. I really like it. I'm perfectly at home out there. I may lose 4 or 5 pounds a show easily, but I don't mind it. You know, I've been doing it ever since I've been in this business.
How do the one-night stands feel? I mean, city to city.
Oh, that's exciting. Used to traveling around and going to the shows and checking it.
So a piece of
and having him say, oh, I knew you from 50 years ago. And I wasn't around 50 years ago.
Remember the piece of film that we saw today? Was it 1968 or something like
that? From the top 10 Outstanding Young
Men. 10 Outstanding Young Men Awards.
Oh, the JC's there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very short.
I was so nervous.
And you made a speech then, right?
Yeah. It's a different ball game when you're going out to sing and you're going out to make a speech. And I had nothing prepared. I was going to go out and just ad lib it. But when I first started talking, my voice was so high. I sounded like somebody else, you know. It was way up here in this register, you know. I was really nervous. I don't know what I said. It's something about a song. I think I used it without a song the day we were in.
You said something interesting leading into that. You said, when I was a kid, I used to read comic books. I was the hero in the comics. When I saw movies, I was the hero in the movies. And I was like, really a beautiful, you know, way to begin the whole projection of being a hero. Suddenly, you've grown up, you are a hero. Now they're kids sitting at home.
You had the line, everything's happened to me 100 times over.
Yeah. Is that what I said?
It was something only you could have said.
It just came to me at the time. I didn't prepare it at all.
The secret that every great man is a good speech writer. That's what you wanted to say, right?
No.
But when you were a kid, did is that how you identified with being a hero, by a comic book or by a newspaper?
Oh yeah,
or,
sure.
Like, who were your heroes?
Just any and everybody that that did anything. Just it's the same today, you know. I watch people who excel in anything, whether it be sports. I'm not a golfer, but I watch the top golfers. tennis player, the chess players. I admire anybody who can do anything of that nature, you know.
When did you first feel that you wanted to be a singer?
When I first realized I could sing, at about 2 years of age, I found myself singing. I mean, I was singing, and people would listen to me around the housing project where I lived. And as time went by, I was about 8 years old, and they entered me in a talent show. I wore glasses. Had no music. And I won, I think it was fifth place in this talent contest, this state talent contest. I got a whipping the same day. My mother whipped me for something. I wanted to ride. Destroyed my ego completely. But I would sing like in church, my mother and father. But you know, when I was about 10 years old, they gave me a choice between a guitar and a bicycle. So I took the guitar and to watch people. I learned to play it. A little bit, but I would never sing in public. I was very shy about it. In 11th grade in school, they entered me in another talent show. Nobody knew I sang anything. I was singing around the apartment building where I lived, but they entered me in this talent show.
Do what? The Colonel story. That's the
Colonel story.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sideburns.
There were some truck drivers, believe it or not, that drove big diesel trucks and so forth across country, and they had scars on them. They were wild looking guys. So I used to lay on the side of the road and watch these guys drive these trucks. And I just, when I was old enough to grow sideburns, I grew them, you know. I got criticized a lot for them, and kicked off the football team and so forth.
You were different than most of the kids then, right? I mean, you dressed differently all?
Well, I suppose so by normal standards, but it was just something I wanted to do. I wasn't trying to be better than anybody else.
Let's go back to the 11th grade talent contest. What happened?
Well, I wasn't, like I said, I wasn't popular in school. I wasn't dating anybody at that school. I failed music. I was taking music. I flunked music just flat. Whew. F, only thing I ever failed. And they entered me in this talent show. And I came out, I did my two songs. And when I came on stage, I heard people kind of rumbling and whispering and so forth. Because nobody knew I even sang, really. And it was amazing how popular I became in school after that.
What did you say?
Let me see. Till I Waltz Again With You by Teresa Brewer. That was a song I was singing. So then I went on through high school and I graduated.
What happened? You never sung in public before. You get out there, you're scared, pissless, and ugly, mm-hmm. And you start to sing. What happens?
Well, about the same thing happened later on at the Shell. You know, the kids and everybody really went, you know, I got 10 or 11 encores, that type of thing. They just kind of halted the show at that period. it scared me, but then I got, it made me very happy too. But I was still shy about it. I wouldn't sing in public for a long time, and I went for maybe a year. I just kind of forgot about it. I got out of school and I was driving a truck. I was dating a girl and waiting for her to get out of school so we could get married. And I was training to be an electrician, because they make $3 an hour. You know, and I was very serious about it. I made the first record really as a personal thing for my mother. And that same company called me a year later and said, "We got a song that you might be able to do." It was 12 o'clock. I said, "Can you be here by 3 o'clock? I was there by the time they hung up the phone. You know. Whoop, I know it, man. So.
What did your dad say about a guy with a guitar?
Yeah.
He still feels that way today.
No, it's funny. I say it to him every once in a while. He just laughs about it. He gets embarrassed if I say it in front of somebody. Now, here I was having an epileptic fit. You know, they just happened to film it.
How old were you then? Do you have any idea?
I was about 19.
You look like you're trying to get your balance.
Oh. What happened to all those movements that you used to do? I noticed you changed them around a lot.
I don't know, I learned better after a while.
What happened when you went on TV that time?
You mean when they filmed me from the waist up? I think it was a matter of, it was new at that time to see anybody's body vibrate or move at all. And that's what I was doing.
When you went on the Sullivan Show, did you know he was going to film you only from the waist up? No.
I wasn't conscious of those type things, you know, really.
But in that day, do you think people thought it was shocking or?
I think so. I think they probably did.
How'd you find out that he had cut it that way, that he had not shot your whole body?
When I saw it. I played back, and I was so busy at that time, man, until I didn't really have time to. You gotta remember, you know, I was just 19. Show me out in the world.
Did things start happening fast?
Yes, very fast.
What happened then?
Well, I started working on those shows with those guys from the opera. Started traveling and doing more TV shows, and I came to Hollywood. I did 4 movies. So everything was happening in a short period of time. And then, right when I was going good, I got drafted. And overnight, it was all gone. It was like a dream. Pow. Changed.
What happened in the Army? What did you expect? What did you find? How did people treat you?
They treated me very well. I've had people ask me if I had a rough time or something. I just did the same thing everybody else did. I didn't ask for anything, and they didn't give me anything, you know. I just did the same thing everybody else did. And I made it very well. I had no trouble at all.
I remember your dad was telling me that they expected you to sing, and, you know, but that you didn't want to make it that kind of a...
Now, they asked me once or twice, like Bob Hope would come over and do his Christmas thing. Christmas show. And they'd put a little pressure on me about doing his shows. And I said, "Gentlemen, I don't have any instruments. I've been in the service about a year. I was a corporal." I said, I don't have any instruments. It'd be difficult for me. I'd have to bring my musicians over here. I will do that. But I didn't want to do it. I just felt I couldn't really mix the two. I couldn't be in show business and be in the service too.
Well, until that period of time, one of the things that I remember, maybe I've heard it, maybe I've read it in books. When you, and I remember from my own experience, I remember being really pissed off at you because the girls that I was going to high school with, that I dug, all were in love with you. That son of a bitch, you know, he's got that, you know.
Well, I had the attitude of screw you, you know.
That's what I wanted to do.
All is fair in love and war, Jack, you know.
Oh, when we were doing the girl from the red?
Yeah, I mean, no, about the guy who was sitting there with his wife.
Oh, yeah, in Buffalo. In Buffalo.
It was in Buffalo.
Yeah, it was in Buffalo.
Was it?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know if I can do the accent, a Buffalo, New York accent, probably. But I had the videotape camera, and I was out in the audience, and we were going to tape that concert so that we could prepare for him to pronounce. And the lady, there's two couples sitting there in their mid-30s or something like that. And the lady is saying, "Oh, I'd give anything if I could just get up and touch him, or maybe he'll kiss me." And he said, "You ain't going up on that stage. You get out of the seat. We screw." You know, and she says, "Oh, if he just, I mean, if I could run up there and just kiss him, it would be just..." And he said, "Myrtle," he said, "you get out of this seat and you find yourself another husband. You touch that son of a bitch and we're through." And I said, "Why am I not filming this?" It was beautiful, and they were sitting right behind me. And she got, like, the rest of the night, they didn't talk, and he sat there like this all night. He wasn't about to get into the concert at all.
Yeah, that's funny. No, I found, you know, through the years that most of the guys are pretty understandable about it, you know.
But you had gotten into some open hostility. Somewhere somebody had punched you or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, I had a few instances like that. Like somebody woke up and asked me for an autograph, take a swing at me. But they realized that I fought back. And I didn't have any trouble like that from the time I got out of the service on. It was just those first few years, it was, I had to watch for it, you know.
Maybe one of the things the Army did is it made you aware of the fact that you could just be accepted as a human being, just another guy.
Well, that's exactly what they did, you know. And we were under wartime conditions in Germany, and I was in a tank corps, so... we were up on the Russian zone most of the time, just on patrol. And the weather was bad. It was 10 degrees below zero. And I tried to keep my morale up and keep going, keep busy.
Were you surprised the fact that suddenly you were just being accepted as another human being?
I was pleased with it, yeah. The first few days, the guys just watched me, kind of watched me to see what I was doing, what I was going to do. When they saw I was doing the same thing that they were, they started to come around and talk to me and ask me questions about what was it like to make a movie, stuff like that. I found myself in Germany, guys would get letters from home. You know, the girl had gone with another guy. They'd come wake me up in the middle of the night, say, ask me about it, ask me to read the letter. I found myself advising these guys what to do. I had a girlfriend too that was ding-a-ling, man, run off with somebody else. But I didn't say anything about my own situation. I just kept it quiet.
You had already made movies then,
but... I had four movies, yeah. Yeah, Love Me Tender, Loving You, Jailhouse Rock, and King Creole.
Now you grow up looking at movies and, you know, wherever you happen to go to movies, you see these heroes up on the screen, suddenly you're going to Hollywood, you're going to get to be one of them. What happened when you came to Hollywood?
Well, by that time, I wasn't thinking along those lines. I didn't associate myself as being that. I was busy with a script. I had to memorize a script. It changed a lot of those things.
It was a lot of work.
Yeah, it was work. It was a job, you know. I had to be there at a certain time in the morning and work a certain amount of hours, and that's exactly how I treated it. So I don't And so I was more concerned about if the picture was any good or if I was any good in it, you know.
There were a lot of action movies. There were always, where you were driving a car or you were...
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people, there's like 32 movies that have gone through it one time or another. A lot of people say, I've heard say, oh, he doesn't give a shit, you know, about his movies. He makes all those movies and they just kind of grind them out. I think I've heard the same criticism. You know, I remember we were talking about Robert Hilbert. Like he did, I don't know what he was looking at, but he says, Elvis, we know different. That's one of the things we want to accomplish in this film. Mm-hmm. He really cares about
when
he goes on stage. He really cares about the movies. Sure. Good or bad. The point is that that you care about those films. You care if they're not good.
Yeah, I care so much until I became physically ill. I would become violently ill. I'd get a temperature or something would happen to me.
What would concern you at the time about the film? What would make you ill?
The fact that I didn't, at a certain stage, I had no say-so in it. I didn't have final approval of the script, which means that I couldn't say this is not good for me, or whatever.
In other words, they just used you. They did anything they wanted to do.
It was that type. It was more or less that type of thing. I don't think anybody was consciously trying to harm me. It was just Hollywood's image of me was wrong, and I knew it, and I couldn't say anything about it. I couldn't do anything about it. I'd be writing to production. I was doing a lot of pictures close together, and the pictures got very similar. A lot of them got very similar, and they, you know, if something was successful, I'd try to recreate it the next time around. So I'd read the first 4 or 5 pages, and I knew that it was just a different name with 12 new songs in it. The songs were mediocre in most cases. You can't get good songs. So that's what might have made it seem like the indifference, you know. But I was never indifferent. I was so concerned until that's all I talked about. It worried me sick, you know. So I had to change it, which I did, you know. I had to change it around.
I was
obligated in like 4 years in advance.
You're not gonna remember things like the great dance sequence in Jailhouse Rock. Now, Jerry told me you choreographed it, you know, your thing yourself. That's a beautiful sequence. Yeah. How did that come about? I mean, how did you get that kind of control?
I just did it, and we had a choreographer that just more or less geared the dances off of what I did. But, I don't know. It's nobody's fault, maybe except my own. I didn't know what to do. I just felt I was obligated very heavily to a lot of times to things that I didn't fully believe in, and that was very difficult. You know.
That's the feeling I got.
Well, the difference was this, I think. Turn it
broad. No.
No, you agree.
Was Elvis's contracts were made up before the scripts. In other words, when people do pictures, they do it by a script. They say, yeah, I'll do this script. Then they do the picture. But Elvis was contracted to do pictures, so he had to do a picture with no matter what they told him to do.
Yeah, you got 5 pictures to do.
You say, you got you do this script.
That's what I'm saying. The movies were made, the contracts were signed like 4 years in advance.
7 pictures, no matter what picture.
So I had thought
that's the difference.
That they would try to get a new property for me or give me a chance to show some kind of acting ability or do a very interesting story. But it did not change. It did not change. And so I became very discouraged. They couldn't have paid me no amount of money in the world to make me feel any self-satisfaction inside.
But yet you still did them. You must force yourself.
I had to.
What kind of film would you have liked to have been? You would have had your choice.
That's hard to say. I would like to have something that was more challenging instead of Hollywood's image of what they thought I was. You know.
There was a whole big image problem. As long as I can remember, I remember 2 extremes of you. I remember in high school, the image was that you were a big, bad, evil kind of guy with sideburns. And yet in the movies, I saw a completely different kind of person. A guy who would rather sing than fight, as one person described it. And it was just like, and yet there was no reality. Between those two extremes, I knew that there was another person. And I think one of the first things I remembered about you is there's some strange distorted image here, which I can't figure out. And I was always used to dealing with people in the one-to-one relationship. And I'd see that image of you and I'd say, I wonder what he really thinks.
I literally took it as long as I could. Physically, emotionally, everything. Just,
that's why when you get on stage, I think it's...
It comes out.
It's honest. It's real. It's you.
Well, it's like you said.
I tell you, I had, like I told you before, I had a completely different image of you until I met you, until I saw you in the live performance, and I think a lot of people do. It's too bad the medium is like that.
Well, not all the movies were that bad. In between, I would do something that was entertaining to people. Would just a pure entertainment nature, so like Tickle Me or something like that, I would do. And they work well on television.
A lot of people still watch it.
Sure.
My sister.
But it got to be a thing also of 10 to 12 songs in a movie. It was very difficult to get good material, and I know good material when I hear it. See. Songs had to fit situations. And I had to gear down to that particular thing, like sing to a dog.
It's hard to see a situation on a record.
Remember this on the Steve Allen show, they had you singing to a hound dog.
Yeah.
That's probably what I
feel. Yeah, that was Steve Allen's humor. And,
actually, Steve.
To me, it was about as funny as a crutch. Again, I had to do that.
He's been one of the few people who've been really very helpful to us. We've sent him a letter and said we'd like to get a tape of an early Elvis TV show. And we've been jerked around by Ed Sullivan. And Alan, like, wrote a letter right away and said, yes, I'd be happy to help, whatever. And he sent one over this afternoon. We haven't looked at it yet.
Well, he was all right. Mm-hmm.
But he's a kind of a strange cornball. Now my voice is on that tape too.
Right. What about some of the people that travel around with you, your friends? Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Well, I can tell you a lot about them, but it was ruining them all.
Oh, sir.
No, I have to have people to work for me that handle the things of a personal nature. Personal travel, wardrobe. Details, personal relations or public relations. I have to have people like that. And it's mostly people that I've known for years. And they know that they are representing me. So.
People that you trust then?
Yeah. And.
So when you go on a tour, what do they do?
Well, they're all pretty well skilled in what they're doing. It's very important, the costume, the wardrobe has to be there, has to be in good shape. So there are people assigned to that. The security is all very well planned out in advance. And I have to have people with me for security. And to make sure that I get to the building on time and get inside. And a couple of guys I met in the Army. I met Joe in the Army. I met Charlie in the Army. And they stayed with me ever since 1960.
How about Sonny and Red and Jerry?
Well, Sonny went to work for me probably 1961.
Red, you went to school with
him. Yeah, went to school with Red. So Red was with me in those early days when I was first traveling around. A lot of times just the two of us,
Being before you, we need a little line, Elvis, like before you go on the tour, we're going to show a rehearsal. Before, maybe you could just say something about preparations before the tour. You get everybody together and that you go over songs.
Most people just think you just walk out on that stage and that's it. No, band strikes up and you...
What happens?
We start discussing the songs first. I have new wardrobe made for every appearance. I don't use the same ones. So there are sketches that have to be drawn up. And have to be fitted, you know, for wardrobe. And then we start talking about songs. I start going through the list of songs, and there must be 400 or 500 songs. Out of that 400 or 500, I have to pick 20 at the most. Then we start rehearsing in a little studio at RCA Victor with a small band, with a rhythm section. And we go through several songs, maybe 50 songs. We do that for several days, and we try to add to it. And then we go to Vegas, and we pick up the voices. We start rehearsing with the voices, then graduate to the big band. But all this starts to take place 2 or 3 months before I ever make a public appearance. It's all planned out. You know.
Are you thinking about things beforehand? I mean, you're...
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, like right now, I'm going into Vegas, and that's just on my mind all the time. Songs, wardrobe, lighting, sound, everything's on my mind, you know.
A lot of times you listen to the radio, hear a song, you know, it's a good song for the show.
It'd be a good stage song, right? Hear somebody else, so I'll do it.
I notice though that when every time you do a song, you do it a certain way. I mean, you do it, you put your own stamp on it. Somehow it takes on a whole different feeling.
Hmm. What I said, that's just me, I guess. I just do the song the way that I feel it, you know.
I asked Jerry about how you got to have an American Trilogy. He told me that you had heard Mickey Newbury do it. Mm-hmm. Mickey had worked with him a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And Chris Christopherson.
I just thought it was a very good idea, you know. And all I did was just to take it and make the sound and expound on it, you know.
What was incredible to me is until it dawned on me, because we're working on the stage and we have a headset on, and things are just happening, you don't really listen to the music, you're too concerned about the camera angles and stuff. That here in American Trilogy, in the South, and I first dawned on me in Richmond, you've got a Union song, you've got basically a black spiritual, and of course you've got a rebel song, and yet that audience is responding from the very first note, and they're taking it all in as their music, and yet, you know, in reality only one of the songs is really, really theirs.
Yeah.
Did you ever think about how they might or might not react to that?
I didn't think about it until I did it on stage. There's one guy one night that had sat through my entire performance in the front stage, I mean the front table, and he had on a cowboy hat. He sat through the entire show, man. There was no reaction much at all. So I started in a Dixie. He stood up and put his hat over his heart. That was it. He sat back down. You know. So just a few funny things would happen. I'd do the song in certain areas and it'd stand up. I'd start doing the other song and it'd sit back down.
It's a powerful song, and it gets a good reaction.
But I've had a lot of good reaction with it.
When's the first time you ever did it? Did you do it in the South? Do you remember what you did?
No, I did it in Vegas.
Vegas, yeah. Last time
in Vegas.
Yeah, I think so. It's, okay. Yeah, it's a little warm in here.
Yeah.
One thing we'd like you to do would really